The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. This week...
The ayes to the right, 242. The noes to the left, 391.
I profoundly regret the decision that this House has taken tonight.
For a few hours, it looked like it might be in the bag. Theresa May's last-minute dash to Strasbourg gave Brexiters the fleeting hope that they'd finally be able to vote for her deal. But it wasn't in the bag. Geoffrey Cox, the ERG and the DUP all searched the bag in vain and found it empty of anything new. May's deal was defeated by a thumping 149 votes, plunging Parliament into chaos. So what happens now? And also this week, Tony Blair left office 12 years ago and remains as divisive a figure as ever. As a new book about the Blair years is released, we consider his legacy. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, well, she tried. Announcing £1.6 billion for poorer towns to win over Labour MPs, making new promises on workers' rights, and racing to Strasbourg for last-minute negotiations on the Irish backstop. And late on Monday night, the government said it had finally persuaded the EU27 to provide legally binding guarantees that would get May's deal over the line. But the guarantees didn't go far enough. Geoffrey Cox couldn't change his legal advice, meaning the DUP and the ERG couldn't climb down their backstop ladders to support the deal. May's deal was defeated and Parliament went into meltdown. Yesterday, members voted to stop a no-deal Brexit, in a vote which won't actually stop a no-deal Brexit. And now May is, incredibly, talking about bringing back her deal for a third time. And in 15 days, we leave the EU. Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Raphael Baer from The Guardian, the New Statesman's economics commentator Grace Blakely, and Henry Newman, Director of Open Europe and the former advisor to Michael Gove. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Raph, what happened yesterday? Talk us through chaos.
Well, you know, for people who like a bit of parliamentary procedure, it was, you know, it was great theatre. The whole thing was slightly ridiculous. I'll try and do the short version. But essentially, the government asked the Commons whether or not, with a motion, a government motion, whether or not it wanted to leave the European Union with no deal, fully anticipating that the government would be able, at least the Prime Minister would be able to support that motion and say, no, actually, on balance, on the 29th of March, we do not want to leave the European Union with no deal. But then there was an amendment, and the amendment took out any reference to the 29th of March and said, actually, you know what, we just don't want to leave with no deal. No deal, off the table completely, please. Now, for reasons that I won't go into, that amendment ended up being actually moved by Yvette Cooper, an opposition MP, and therefore wasn't that the text of that amendment superseded, replaced the government amendment. The government amendment, therefore, was no longer a government amendment, and the government, therefore, couldn't vote for it. So you had the slightly ridiculous spectacle of the Prime Minister essentially voting against a proposition, the guts of which she had supported only moments before, because technically the motion that she was voting on wasn't her motion anymore. And you had cabinet ministers and other ministers who still supported the substance of the motion abstaining, thereby effectively defying Tory government whips on a government vote. And the short outcome of this is that, yes, Parliament has once again said that it does not want to leave the European Union with no deal. We knew that anyway. Legally, it doesn't actually prevent the UK leaving the EU with no deal, because that can only be agreed with the EU. So on that substantial legal point, nothing has changed, except for the fact that somehow, out of this situation, Theresa May managed to shed even more authority, and the government managed to look even more chaotic, and the Commons managed to look even further out of touch with what it needs to do to be able to somehow salvage a functional outcome from this whole Brexit situation.
Henry, how likely is no deal still, even if MPs now say they don't want it?
I mean, it remains a possibility, but I think we're looking at only a really very slim chance. And it, I think, look, this is not legally binding yet. Nothing in statute has changed, but clearly it'd be very, very hard for the government to avoid implementing the cleared will of Parliament here. So I think it's morally binding. And if they chose to try to ignore it, they'd clearly be in breach of the requirements to respond to the will of the Commons. They could easily be put into contempt of Parliament. So I just don't think that's a realistic option. And the Brexit choices are now narrowing. And I think that's been apparent for quite a while, that Parliament would oppose no deal, but the penny had not yet dropped with certain Eurosceptics. I think we're beginning to see the penny dropping faster. You said in your introduction that the Prime Minister brought back some changes from Strasbourg. Those changes were, I think, were more substantive than many realised initially. The Attorney General's legal advice pointed out that a certain legal risk remained unchanged. And that was that if we ended up in the backstop putting forward solutions, if we couldn't find a solution that worked, we could still be trapped in the backstop. That remains the case. However, what was sort of missed in that drama of, around his last-minute advice on Tuesday morning ahead of the government's defeat on the second meaningful vote on Tuesday afternoon was that he also said that the legal advice, the legal risk of a different scenario had substantially reduced. And that scenario was that the UK did put forward workable solutions for the Irish border, and the French or the other European countries just said, no, we're not interested. You're staying in the backstop just because we want to, in spite, arbitrarily trap you there until you give us loads of your fish or loads of concessions on other stuff. And that risk has reduced. And of course, that risk was a very legitimate, real concern, because if you're a Brexiteer, Eurosceptic MP, you think you've got these answers to the Irish border. And what you're worried about is what President Macron said back in November, which is that they can use the backstop as a trap, as a lever to extract concessions. We now know that that's not the case. So I think there's interest in Brexit wings of the Tory party in looking again at some of this. And although the Prime Minister didn't manage to convince enough of her MPs to pass the deal, she did get some quite key people moving across. Above all, David Davis, former Brexit Secretary, he backed the deal. And he is, of course, somebody who resigned over Chequers. So she's now able to stand up and say, well, look, David Davis didn't want Chequers. He was unhappy with my Brexit policy, but he thinks that we should leave with this deal. And I think that will help persuade more Eurosceptic MPs over the coming days.
I want to come on to MV3, Meaningful Vote 3, or, you know, more meaningful votes, less, you know, however many there's going to be over the course of the next few days. It could be more, I suppose. Grace, on that, the first meaningful vote, there was all this talk, wasn't there? There's, you know, she's going to win over Labour MPs by these great big promises on workers' rights and delegations of MPs going in to see her about money for their towns, 1.6 billion. That literally delivered one MP, Caroline Flint. So why didn't it work?
I think as the threat of no deal recedes, most of these MPs have kind of little to no incentive to ever get behind something that Theresa May would want to deliver. And I think especially as there's lots of stuff going on in the background right now. And I think there are a lot of people working behind the scenes to try and, well, basically kind of work around this solution of indicative votes. And I think most Labour MPs, actually almost regardless of where they are in the party, seem to be converging around this idea that they need some sort of soft Brexit, which is actually where the party's been for quite a while, whether that's, you know, probably something along the lines of staying in the customs union. Having said that, that scenario looking slightly more likely might tempt more ERG members into voting for May's deal and the next meaningful vote, even more meaningful than the last. But again, as Henry was saying, it is all a question about whether or not they feel like they're going to end up getting trapped in the backstop. There was some talk, I remember, when Geoffrey Cox was delivering his advice about the Vienna Convention, wasn't there, about whether or not you can unilaterally leave a treaty, which I think, you know, maybe at some point provided a way for the ERG maybe to say, oh, we might be able to kind of to stretch this. You know, whilst it is almost completely unprecedented for a government to be bringing legislation to the Commons for a third time that's essentially unchanged each time, it may be the case that she ends up getting this through this time.
Henry, can you talk us through a bit about that, this idea of the Vienna Convention being used? And hopefully listeners will bear with us. But this, I think it's quite important because it might be the thing that the government needs to just extend that ladder a tiny bit more upwards towards the ERG.
Right. And we saw late on sort of in the debate on Tuesday, Jacob Rees-Mogg, really in the last seconds of the debate before it's put to a vote at 7 p.m, ask the Brexit secretary about the Vienna Convention, and clearly he wasn't able to get quite enough of a ladder that he was looking for. But I think this is swinging around. And what the Attorney General's advice said was that the legal risk remains unchanged unless fundamental circumstances alter, and that is a legal test. I'm not an international lawyer, so I don't want to go too far, but I took the precaution of dating one. And he's been able to, he's come together with a legal opinion that I've written up earlier today on Conservative Home, which goes through some of the possibilities around it. I don't want to overstate this because I think a fundamental change of circumstances is quite a high bar. I think if you can look at it along with what I think is much more important in the rest of the Strasbourg package, this idea that the EU can't simply seek to replace the backstop with something that sounds like a backstop, swims like a backstop, and quacks like a backstop, i.e. a customs union. The EU will have to not just take seriously what we put forward as a replacement for the backstop, but actively put forward their own proposals. And if they don't, they would be in breach of the best endeavours good faith clauses, and the UK could then seek to do various other things. I'm not saying that that means we can simply walk off in a huff and pull a nice unilateral exit lever. No, we didn't get that. It's not everything that some of the Eurosceptics wanted. But our legal position is clearly a lot better this week, if we do end up passing the deal, than it was before the Prime Minister went to Strasbourg.
I think, can I just add to that, the most important thing that Geoffrey Cox said on Tuesday was not his legal advice. It's when he, at the end of the statement, said, this is a political choice you've got to
make.
It's not about the law. You know, and Vienna Conventions and all the other protocols. Look, the reality is a lot of the people who, you know, we talk about ladders to climb down, which I think is an important metaphor, because it's a pretext, an excuse people need to be able to essentially vote for something in March that they openly despised in January, because substantially, obviously, it's the same, largely. Why is everyone so concerned about the backstop on that side of the argument? Because they recognise that there literally isn't actually an available solution to the Irish border question. If there was, if somehow the technological mechanisms were in any way viable over the next 2 years, you wouldn't ever be, end up in the backstop.
Well, I think let me finish
the point. And so ultimately, the legal concern, this idea that there has to be some legal mechanism by which you can evade the backstop and that allows you to vote for the deal, for the hardest Brexiteers, they were not worried about legal niceties when they were saying, and as they still sometimes do, well, you could just walk away completely, do WTO rules, rip up the EU treaties, no one really cares. Ultimately, if the question is, what are your legal obligations towards the European Union, or how would you like your relationship with other European Union countries to work in the light of law and treaty, you wouldn't have been talking about walking away from the negotiations, you wouldn't be talking about no deal, you wouldn't be talking about bogus global trade deals on WTO terms. So the whole legal thing is a massive red herring. They just need a political choice. Do they want to actually leave the European Union with a deal? And are they afraid that if they hold out too long, they're going to end up losing Brexit altogether?
I think you need to understand the kind of psychology of many people in the ERG. And I like to think that I would be someone that might be able to give an insight on that, given that I sat very close to Jacob Rees-Mogg on Question Time recently. You have to understand this as, they're pushing for no deal in an attempt to, get us out on WTO rules, rip all these treaties and implement this kind of disaster capitalist agenda that sees us turned into this, tax haven off the coast of Europe. I was speaking to some of my non-political friends last night and they were like, why on earth are these Tory MPs sabotaging this deal? And I was kind of explaining it to them and they were like, but that's never going to happen. What are they doing? And I think the only way to understand this is to like almost view the way they look at Brexit almost in like millenarian terms, as this could be this kind of break where we start this new world order where Britain is once again at the centre and we're able to have this kind of low tax, low regulation, perfect capitalist utopia.
Henry, do you think that's right? I kind of feel like I've detected a bit of a softening of Rees-Mogg, perhaps not other people like Steve Baker, but
I think there is definitely a softening. I think going back to something Grace just said, this sort of millenarian idea that some people have, I'm not going to look into the heart of the soul of some members of the ERG, but I do think we used to say we don't have a national religion other than the NHS. Brexit is in danger of becoming our national religion, where we split into these tribes who believe incredibly passionately in different things. Yes, of course, at some point in a negotiation, you look at all the legal risks, but you make a political decision. That's the same in business. That's the same in any decision. Having said that, there are, of course, some real concerns about the backstop. And I think the EU has said all the way through, you can only negotiate the divorce in Article 50. But, oh, by the way, we need to bind you into a future relationship, which creates a baseline for the way we'll work together. That is unfair. So I think there has been a real and legitimate concern about all of that. But there is a lot of unreality here on all sides of Parliament. Labour are opposing the current deal because they want to have a softer deal, which is a customs union, potentially some more access to the single market, which is already allowed under the existing deal. Their proposal is to change nothing of the existing binding parts, existing binding parts of the deal. It's a totally spurious artificial dividing line. And I think what's amazing in all of this political maelstrom this week is the absence of the Labour Party leadership. This should have been a huge moment for the Labour Party. Where was Jeremy Corbyn? He forgot to mention the party's central policy of a second referendum on Tuesday night.
I'm not sure. I mean, is that the party's central policy, Ralph?
Well, the policy has been agreed at conference. It seems pretty clear, I think, that certainly the leader's office doesn't really want to have a referendum and yet is obliged to support notionally the prospect of having one because that's, you know, a lot of Labour Party do. I mean, all parties are these weird coalitions of often now completely conflicting ideas and interests. I think one of the central dynamic in terms of the weird theatre that we saw last night in Parliament, and I actually agree with Henry, that it was very striking actually how Yvette Cooper was the sort of the engine of as it were the political agency on the opposition benches on that, although actually her position on Brexit isn't that different from Jeremy Corbyn's. I don't think she wants a referendum either. No. I mean, she's actually very leavey, you know, so in that sense what we have is this. Yeah, I think she'd disagree with Jeremy Corbyn and lots of other things, but you have this weird situation now where the ambition in Parliament to coalesce around something that is a viable Brexit outcome is in fundamental tension with the interests of MPs to stay within their prescribed colour-bound party identities, Labour, Tory. And one of those things has to snap. You know, at some stage, you're going to need dozens and dozens of MPs who are notionally Tory MPs voting for something that really is a Labour, has become a Labour proposition, like the customs union, or dozens of Labour MPs just going across and saying, OK, we literally no longer care what our leader thinks.
Exactly.
We're going to go over something else. Something's going to break.
This is about, I mean, at this point, you know, this is about practicality. And I don't think it's fair to say that the Labour leadership has been absent or is kind of being unrealistic, because Labour is defending literally the only thing that has a majority in the Commons. You know, all very well talking about a second referendum, it would never get through because, you know, even some people who advocate Remain or a softer Brexit do not want to see a second referendum happen for very good reasons.
We may see that tested tonight. Sorry. Because there's an amendment down in the name of some Labour MPs as well as Tory MPs, yeah, which will say that we should not have a second referendum.
But Henry's absolutely right. There is nothing in the withdrawal agreement that actually prevents Labour from enacting what it says its Brexit policy actually is. If Labour MPs wanted to actually do the Brexit that Jeremy Corbyn says he wants to do without crashing out with no deal, for the last months, actually the rational, practical, most efficient way to do that would have been to vote for the withdrawal agreement.
There needs to be some sort of kind of compromise on what it says in the political declaration. If it doesn't matter, then why is there so much getting in the way?
The withdrawal agreement, not the declaration.
Well, I mean, it does matter.
And also, even more sillily in one respect, is that any future government could make a decision at any future point to find a softer relationship. If Labour get into power, say in 2022, say in 2027, whenever they get into power, they could form a permanent customs union, they could negotiate to harmonise on Labour rights with the EU, they could join the EU again. This is all for the future. So we're having a completely bizarre argument about the non-binding bits of the deal, when, of course, Parliament, whatever is signed off in the divorce, will have to ratify that, and MPs will get a vote on it
again,
in the future.
This is becoming, again, like, legalistic. This is about political reality, isn't it? Because, because of the political reality, the political declaration matters. Because of the political reality, it's not going to be the case that the next Labour government can just be like, oh, we're renegotiating the, you know, Brexit again. We're bringing that back into the centre of the political debate. I do think, you know, it does matter what happens and what compromises there are and who, you know, comes forward to say, here's a sensible agreement, and whether or not people step up in the kind of interests of getting this done.
The other interesting thing is that, obviously, one of the central criticisms of the Labour Party was that David Cameron called a referendum for party management purposes. Jeremy Corbyn is proposing a referendum for party management purposes. This is all getting very strange.
I want to ask, first of all, very quickly, to if we can put some predictions for MV3, and then afterwards a brief choose-your-own-adventure of what happens next if it doesn't pass. So, Raph, what do you think it'll pass on the third go? What's the conditions that need to happen for it to pass?
Well, I mean, I think Henry outlined very well, you know, what the sort of practical question in terms of the choices that, you know, the DUP and ERG hardliners need to make, and I think a lot of them will start making that choice. The thing is, for every time we've had a meaningful vote before, previously it has been possible to say, oh, well, look, some people will climb down. Ultimately, they want to get it over the line. And people have found reasons not to do that. And I think that a structural problem here is that there is a hardcore, not the DUP here, actually, a hardcore of conservative, Eurosceptic fanatics, religious zealots, who ultimately do not want to own the outcome of this because they have so much invested in complaining about the outcome of it. And they do not want to be responsible. They do not. So, you know, and I don't think Jacob Rees-Mogg is necessarily among them, actually, but there are some of them who, it's almost as if they would go so far as they would rather lose Brexit and have the grievance of having had their Brexit taken away from them than ever be in the situation of saying, I am satisfied with this Brexit outcome. And that creates a numbers problem, but there might be enough Labour MPs ultimately who would come across so she could get it over the line. But it'll be close. But I think it's possible. possible that she gets over the line on Tuesday.
Henry?
So I think what we tend to hear from a lot on the media is inevitably some of the very hardline Eurosceptic MPs, exactly as Raf is saying, who are never going to come across Marc Francois, for example, possibly Steve Baker. I think she needs to do at least three things to get this through. One of which is she has to move it to a free vote. Her party is already treating all of her votes as a free vote anyway. She has literally zero authority. This is how the Conservatives got the UK into the EU in the first place. In the equivalent of the meaningful vote back in the 70s, they had a free vote. The Labour Party whipped against it. But the fact that the Tories had done a free vote allowed Labour rebels to come across. I think she needs to do that. Point two, she needs to get the DUP on board. The DUP are not completely implacable. They have real concerns about divergence across the Irish Sea. They need a role for Stormont in doing that. That is already allowed under the existing terms of the backstop, which has not been well understood. But because there's zero trust in Karen Bradley, the Northern Ireland Secretary, that the UK has not been able to persuade the DUP that they'd actually do this. I just can't understand why the government hasn't been able to do it, but they need to do it now, and they need to get the EU to agree that that's how we will operate our side of the backstop. Totally doable. Third point, very unfairly, because if she gets her deal through, she will have achieved a completely incredible political turnaround. But politics is unfair. She needs to set out her timetable to go. My friends in government would hate me for saying this, but it's the basic reality, because all of her critics on the Eurosceptic side are the same ones who voted against her leadership back in December. And they want to see a different leader of the Conservative Party take forward phase three. And that, of course, I think also gives a very, very big scalp to the Labour Party, who can then turn around and say, by the way, the Prime Minister's resigned over this, and they will know that a general election is therefore more likely soon afterwards, giving them a chance to, after all, shape the future, which is exactly what, as Grace was saying, the Labour Party think quite rightly they have concerns about.
Grace?
So if May manages to do everything that Henry just said, which I think would be a feat, especially given that she looks and sounds absolutely exhausted and it doesn't seem to be kind of within the realms of her capabilities as a prime minister, then maybe she'll get it through. But there is such a kind of thin line there that, you know, even if she's a couple off, because the majority is so small, there would need to be a lot of Labour MPs that would go over to kind of make it comfortable in any way, shape or form. And I just don't think that that's going to happen as we start to kind of see that there are other options that become more likely that are on the table. So, I mean, it's going to be close. It's difficult making predictions this close to the line because you're so likely to be wrong.
It seems so far away.
I
even
know.
Still.
I don't think, I'm going to say tentatively, I don't think that she'll get it through on the third time.
What about the fourth?
Finally, if she doesn't get it through, are we looking at a very long extension? Are we looking at a sudden soft Brexit compromise? Are we looking at a second referendum? Are we looking at a general election? Or will there be a fourth vote maybe, you know, a couple of days before Brexit? What will happen, Raf?
Well, all of those things. there'll be an extension. Yeah, the EU27 will not push the UK off the cliff on the 29th. So there will be an extension. And then what the nature of that extension is will be negotiated not here. That is a decision that the council will make, and they make it by unanimity, and they will offer the UK something and the UK will take it. Now, then the question is, are there other kind of political things that can be given to Theresa May to help her do some of the stuff that Henry was talking about or in some other capacity? The answer is no. There will be nothing more politically from Brussels for Theresa May apart from the terms of the extension, because they recognise that her authority is now spent. She can't give anything. And so whatever they give her is wasted. And therefore, I think that feeds into the dynamic again that Henry was talking about, which I think is right, that we are now very probably, once transition is locked down, moving into a post-Theresa May conversation, actually, just because you will need someone else to be having the conversation with the Europeans who will have,
and the Labour Party
and Labour Party who will have some, or MPs formerly of the Labour Party, whatever happens on that side, who will have some credible explanation for how what they want to happen might happen in Parliament, because Theresa May doesn't have that.
Henry?
I think it's unlikely that the European Union give much more, but I think what they could do is stamp off and certify and put a nice bow on domestic commitments that she makes that ultimately don't change anything they've already agreed. So, for example, going back on Stormont Lock, they've already said in their joint instrument that this is how we could operate our side of the joint instrument, being what was agreed in Strasbourg on Monday night. They've already said that we can operate our side of the backstop how we like. So all that she needs to get agreed to help get the DUP over is that at the council they say, yeah, That's how you're going to do it. Great. This is exactly what Denmark did in 1992. Denmark was worried. The Danish people were worried that they could be sold out by the Danish government in future and got the European Council to offer them protections against their own government. We're in a similar position here where MPs are worried about what a future UK government could do and want protections from the EU against their own government. So I think, look, it's absolutely right, as Raf's saying, the EU are not going to reopen negotiations. The whole ERG argument, the negotiations are still ongoing. We can't take no deal off the table. I mean, look, the negotiations closed in December. We've been tweaking it since then. Bizarrely, though, the EU still are very worried about no deal. They think, if you talk to people in the Commission, no deal is by far the most likely outcome. But that just speaks to the gulf that we've seen throughout this process and understanding of the UK side of the EU and of the EU side of the UK. But I think what the EU may well do is actually quite helpful for Theresa May, which is to say you can have that short extension up to the end of May, maybe up to the end of June, if you've already passed your deal. Otherwise, you're looking at a very, very long extension. MEPs, European elections in the UK, and I think that will be very, very hard for a lot of parliamentarians, and that will help force the choice, whether it's meaningful vote three, meaningful vote four, or whatever else. Ultimately, a version of the Prime Minister's deal, whether or not the future is tweaked, is by far the most likely outcome.
Grace?
So if she doesn't pass meaningful vote three, we obviously get a short extension, probably up to the point of the elections. And in that intervening period, you're going to, you know, there's obviously going to have to be a meaningful vote for, with potentially some amendments, with maybe something politically from the EU, but nothing that's really going to change the legal situation. And the most important thing at that point is going to be figuring out who's going to replace Theresa May, because at that point she will have completely lost all of her authority. And I agree that we're going to have to see someone else stepping up and potentially taking that forward. I think at that point, actually, a second referendum and a general election becomes even less likely, because you're getting this so up to the line that at that point you're either looking at a two-year extension, which would be a complete anathema to almost every MP, or you're looking at having to deal with this situation until the end of that first extension. And at that point, you know, you're not going to have any time to refresh the democratic process. So you'll probably have some sort of situation again in which, you know, we have another Tory leader being toppled in a kind of internal election without that being taken to the country. So I think that'll be a very interesting situation.
Okay, we'll wrap things up there, but thanks all, and we'll be back after this.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Now, it seems like the worst thing you can call anyone these days is a Blairite, with centrists running close second. Tony Blair dominated British politics for 13 years, winning three elections in a row for New Labour. But 1997 now seems a very long time ago, and the election of Jeremy Corbyn seemed to be a riposte to the Blair years in the Iraq War. Now, John Davis and John Rentoul have written a book, Heroes or Villains? The Blair Government Reconsidered, interviewing most of the main players in the Blair government, including Blair himself. Heather Stewart met John Davis, and he began by taking us back to 1997.
Blair was under very few of the pressures that other prime ministers have found themselves under. I mean, you just think about, they were the two biggest electoral victories since the Second World War. Bigger than Thatcher, bigger than Attlee in their pomp. So that's the first thing to think about. Just think about that personal mandate. Secondly, no economic crisis, no quarter of negative growth throughout the Blair years. Plenty of money to go round. Thirdly, you've got the whole idea of, after 18 years out, everyone was just so inexperienced.
Of course.
And then you've got the whole idea of losing four elections meant that the Labour left was quite cowed. You put that all together, Blair was under very little pressure.
And how well did he use that amazing opportunity, which obviously someone like Theresa May, trying to operate day to day in a hung parliament with a divided party and, you know, an incredibly complicated set of negotiations, you know, how well did he use those immense advantages?
Well, I think that you've got to look at the proof is in the pudding. For lots of people, Blair used his power badly when it came to Iraq. I mean, we just note in the book, we got a very big chapter on Iraq, and we note in the book that the Chilcot inquiry, possibly the biggest inquiry ever into British government activity, neither said that he lied nor that it was illegal, even though the received wisdom is that he lied and that it was illegal. The other point is that in every constituency up and down the land, you can see new schools and new hospitals, and those are new Labour Blair years legacies. Don't get me wrong, I'm not denigrating Brown. He was a Chancellor like no other. But when it comes to a new Labour legacy, boy, that was unprecedented.
In terms of Iraq, there's whether it was illegal and whether he lied, but which is the thing, as you said, it's flippantly said quite often. It's also whether it was the right use of political capital, isn't there? When, you know, as you say, he had an immense opportunity to do things.
Iraq is the great story, isn't it? It's you know, the power that Blair had. I mean, if you remember and you recall when 9/11 happened, and 9/11 is the key, you know, as everyone, you know, who thinks about this, who were there at the time, it changed everything. And if you'll recall, the day that 9/11 happened, the moment that it happened, Blair was about to give a speech, I think it was to the TUC, actually really hardening his idea that we were going to go into the euro. And so a lot of people would actually say, so it's one of the great speeches that was never delivered. And a lot of people would say that Blair used the political capital that he'd had just four months after the 2001 electoral. It wasn't a landslide. You can't have two landslides. It was enormous, 167 majority. What we got is Blair using that immense political capital and persuasive power to take this country to support the US-led invasion. I mean, one of the points of the book is that we think that Britain is far too Anglo-centric when we think about Iraq. Iraq was going to happen whether we were there or not. And if you remember on the eve of war, Rumsfeld said, well, you can be there or not. This was going to happen. We decided to be there. Blair used all of his rhetoric in a way that George Bush could not, and I think that that's a key point. But at the same time, 9/11, if you know, people have to put their minds back, you know, the whole nuclear proliferation, which seems to have calmed down for the moment, certainly from the media, but was absolutely prevalent, the way that North Korea, the way that Iran, the way that Pakistan, the way that South Africa, the way that Libya were looking at nuclear weapons all on this AQ Khan network. And this was the whole idea. And the thing that one of the lines in Blair's autobiography, which I think that he does for effect, he downplays for effect, where he asked the rhetorical question on 9/11, if Al-Qaeda could have killed 30,000 rather than 3,000, they would have done it. I think it's fair to say if they could have killed 30 million, they would have done it. And they were keen on nuclear. They weren't close to it, but they were keen on it.
Yeah, so it's easy to forget with hindsight, isn't it? The kind of the peril of that moment, or the belief how perilous that moment was.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what we try to do, and this is where the historical method comes in, the rigour, I think, is to really try to recreate what it was like and why decision-making went the way that it did. But I've also got to say, as I said, as I've always said, is that I was 51% against Iraq at the time. I still am 51% against it now. I can see the reasons for, I can see the reasons against. And I think we all know, certainly in the aftermath of Syria, that intervening has a terrible price, but not intervening has a terrible price.
But the point is, these decisions are very difficult and they're made in a particular context at the time.
And I wouldn't want to be Prime Minister.
God, certainly not. Let's talk about the domestic agenda a bit. You talked about those lovely shiny schools and hospitals. It got said afterwards, didn't it? Not least by subsequent Labour leaders, think about Ed Miliband, that government was too satisfied with the kind of status quo in terms of the economy, the role of financial institutions, you know, regulation of markets, and could have taken those huge majorities and used them to carry out more dramatic sort of economic or social reform, more redistribution, been more radical.
I mean, when we talk about, you know, the domestic agenda, Was it radical enough? I think I personally think that in the situation that they found themselves, they could have been a bit more radical. And indeed, Blair says this. Indeed, if you recall, later on as Prime Minister at conference time, we are best when we're at our boldest. And in his book, he says all the time, you know, like, I always felt that if we came, that I should have been bolder, and that I reproach myself for hedging and whatever. He always wanted to be bold. He puts in his book how his soul is that of a rebel, you know, all this sort of idea. Always wanted to be Mick Jagger, if you'll remember. But one of the points of this is that I personally think, and I've never been a member of a party, that this was historically a very radical government. And so you can always ask for more. You can always reproach yourself for not doing enough, of course. But I think that by comparison, you know, just think back, you know, like what the Labour governments of the 1960s, 1970s, they spoke big. Did they deliver? You think about, you've got to go back to the Attlean 1945, 1951, when you had true radicalism. But that was on the back of the greatest war the world's ever seen. You know, I wish they'd gone further. You know, I've always believed that private schools are one of the real problems of the country. I wish they'd have touched that, but they didn't. And I think that that's a disappointment. But at the same time, wow, I think it was impressive.
It's easy again to forget the context, isn't it? It gets said in a very sort of pat way now. I mean, there's a lot more that could have been done.
Well, of course. I mean, if you think also 1997 to 1999, because Labour lost all trust over the economy, we had that position whereby Brown and Blair promised to stick to Ken Clark's spending plans, which Ken Clark subsequently said he wouldn't have done. Now, the really intriguing point about that 97-99 period is that that was a time when we had a surplus on the government budgets. These things don't come around often historically. So you had a time where Labour had handcuffed itself to not spend at a time when there was lots more money around.
That was partly about the legacy of the 92 campaign, wasn't it?
Not just 92, but I think 87.
And going
I think it was 83. I think it was 1979. I think you go back to the IMF crisis, 1976.
You can't trust Labour with the economy.
Of course you can't.
Theresa May still says it now.
Well, yeah, exactly. But the great joy, as you know, was that John Major presided over the ERM crisis, where Gordon Brown then said, you can't trust the Tories with the economy.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know you're not going to answer this, but hero or villain?
Oh, I think mostly hero.
mostly hero. John Davis, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
John Davis talking to Heather Stewart there. Grace, did Blair create Corbynism?
Very good question. Blair didn't create Corbynism. And I think it's interesting that this book is framed in terms of heroes and villains and that kind of individualistic narrative about great men who drive history. Because ultimately, Blair was a product of his time. The kind of political economic settlement that underpinned Blairism was based on, you know, that period that we had of finance-led growth, where you had a massive boom in the finance sector, you had ever-increasing levels of private debt sustaining that kind of long moderation that most people put down to the kind of sound economic management of policymakers, which actually turned out just to be a massive bubble. And that, you know, led to a particular political settlement, which was based on the idea that you wouldn't challenge any of the kind of fundamental economic institutions that underpin free market capitalism. You'd just do a little bit of redistribution around the edges. And that was essentially what Blairism was based on, accompanied by obviously, you know, deregulating that finance sector in order to maximize those revenues and, you know, increase the amount of debt that was created, driven into the housing market. Obviously, that blew up. You know, it didn't start in the UK, but there was the same model that was being pursued in the US and the UK. And since then, you know, political reality has come to the fore again. And those economic questions about who gets the gains from growth, of kind of the political relations that are embedded within the institutional settlement that governs the economy, have suddenly become important again. And those are the questions about how we manage our economy, about who has the kind of economic power that underpin Corbynism. So I don't necessarily think that Blair kind of caused Corbynism. I think, you know, Blair was a product of his time. Corbyn is a product of his time. History kind of moves forward in these particular ways that are governed just as much by, you know, the balance of power in society and the balance of economic forces as by the actions of great men.
Well, I think Thatcher created Blairism, which I think is a different line here. So Thatcher's greatest legacy was that the next leader of the Labour Party, the only Labour leader in history who won three consecutive elections, was somebody who believed in the power of the free market. I think what we could say, though, is that Blair set the course for Brexit. because I think it was the changes to our relationship with the EU agreed under the Labour government between 1997 and 2010, which were never put to a referendum despite huge pressure in the UK and promises to do so, that created this sense that we were somehow on an out-of-control juggernaut and our relationship was becoming politically unsustainable. And that's why when the Conservatives got in 2010, they had to promise that any future treaty changes would be put to a referendum. We forget all this now, but in 2011, when Cameron sort of did his almost veto of a new EU treaty, that would have had to go to a referendum. And because Blair never put the constitutional treaty, or later the Lisbon treaty as it then became, to a referendum, there was no safety valve that the public could say, no, this is too much. And then that meant that when the Brexit referendum was put, forget all the arguments about 350 on the side of a bus, what people really felt was that this was their last chance to vote no to a project that they hadn't been able to give their consent to before, and they thought they wouldn't have another chance to give their consent to again, potentially in their lifetime. So I think that was very, very formative, and it's Blair's approach to our relationship in Europe that has caused such long-term damage and led to Brexit. Finally, I'd say that one of the ironies of all this is that when Blair was in government, he found a space for MPs like Corbyn on his backbenchers, and they were tolerated, they weren't adored within the Labour Party, but they had their position, and the Labour Party was able to be a broad and inclusive church with many different ideas. That's clearly not the case now under Jeremy Corbyn, and that's, I think, hugely to the detriment of the current Labour Party.
Raph, Blair and Alistair Campbell, broad and inclusive?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. There is this sort of account of that story that makes it sound a bit like sort of Jurassic Park, where, you know, they said, oh, we've got these cute dinosaurs, you can drive around and look at them, but it's all right, they're essentially harmless. And then they suddenly break out and start gobbling everything up. You know, but what's fascinating about this period we're talking about is that it's just in that weird, uncanny valley between proper history and recent memory, and it's very hard to process in that way because, you know, as Henry and Grace have both said, we're sort of still, you know, we're still feeling the very current ripples and shocks from that moment. It's, you know, what's interesting, I think, is actually in terms of the legacies for country and party, is that you have this situation where Labour culture is turned very ferociously against, essentially collectively against Tony Blair. I mean, there are still Blairites in the Labour Party, but broadly speaking, the prevailing cultural narrative of the Labour Party now is not pro Tony Blair. I'm not sure how healthy that's been for the Labour Party. The cultural legacy for the Conservative Party of their longest serving, you know, in quotes, greatest Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, is exactly the opposite. She is still sort of sanctified in a way that I think is also unhealthy. And I often wonder, you know, which is more damaging, the Labour Party's inability to like Tony Blair or the Conservative Party's inability to dislike Margaret Thatcher. It's that same sense that it just takes a while to process these things. And then they haven't been bedded down as history yet. It's too recent.
I don't think it's fair to say that there's a culture within the Labour Party of hating Tony Blair. I think most of the new members that have rejoined to make it now, you know, this huge mass movement, dislike Tony Blair. Many of them left the Labour Party, and primarily not even because of any of the issues we're talking about, but because of the Iraq War. Like, that was the big thing that changed everything. And I think it's perfectly legitimate for people to have very strong views about that and about his general attitude towards international intervention. I think the other question about, you know, that Henry raised about whether or not the Labour Party has become desperately intolerant. I mean, yes, fine, Blair permitted Corbyn to stay on the backbenches, but what else was he going to do? You know, the situation that we're in now is one in which a whole host of MPs are deciding to leave, you know, many of whom are faced by deselection from their local members, right? And that's relating not to kind of changes in the cultural narratives of the Labour Party. It's a transformation in the structures and the institution and the way it works, which have derived from the fact that it's become this mass membership organisation. And that, again, relates to changes in political economy, of people kind of deciding, actually, there is an alternative to the current model, and we need to get involved in politics in order to try and change that.
I think one very quick thing. I mean, I think what you are seeing with the current Labour Party under Corbyn is a tolerance from people in senior constituency Labour parties who are pursuing essentially vendettas against individual MPs, viz. Luciana Berger from her own constituency association. I think that's completely different from under Blair. Secondly, on conservative modernisation versus Labour modernisation, I think what's interesting about the way that the Conservative Party changes is that it moves to a new position and adopts that as the new normal. For example, same-sex marriage, only passed in this country because of Labour MPs backing it, despite David Cameron whipping his party for it. But it's unthinkable. We're talking about a future Conservative leadership race. Unthinkable that any future Tory leader would not be somebody who actively backed now same-sex marriage. And the Conservative Party, the way it evolves is that it moves position and then that becomes the new normal, the baseline. And then it moves on again. Whereas the Labour Party, I think, has gone through this interesting phase of continually going back to an old argument because people were told that you can't be genuinely on the left if you want to win elections. And that argument...
You're talking about the changes in institutional settlements. Because if you think about the post-war period, you know, it wasn't the case that the Conservatives developed by suddenly accepting the fact that there was this completely new balance of power between Labour and capital and they were going to accept the fact that the unions had increased massively. Whereas today, they are more likely to accept small changes to what is basically a kind of settlement that's associated with finance-led growth. We're talking about structural institutional changes. And the Tories, during the post-war period, wanted a structural institutional change that they got in the 80s. Labour today want a structural institutional change.
I think there are a lot of Conservatives now who actually recognise that Jeremy Corbyn has won important economic arguments, and whether they can genuinely and who really sincerely understand the need for something that actually goes back to a slightly more redistributive social democratic settlement in order to win back a lot of votes and win back legitimacy in the country. There are also some very radical turbo Thatcherites who don't accept that, but that's going to be the post-Brexit dividing line in the Conservative Party.
Absolutely right.
I agree.
Okay, thanks all. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Raphael Baer, Grace Blakely and Henry Newman and John Davis. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.